Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. He was trying to get the Tiffany's next to the Trump Tower, and it was a little hard to get there through the security for the president-elect. So Dennis Gartman decided to darken the door. Good morning, sir.
You guys will apparently let anybody on this show nowadays.
Help the liberals of America with the surprise of the election. I would suggest a Virginia, North Carolina guy like you really wasn't all that surprised. Assist the progressives listening.
People need to get in an airplane and fly over the great flyover part of the United States.
And go there.
It actually is quite civilized. You'd be surprised. There are very nice, well-spoken, erudite people living in Peoria who are reasonably well-read, who are cognizant of what goes on in the rest of the country and are different than the coasts. But that's indeed what happened.
Some of them,
it was not all that surprising.
Maybe you wrote about this morning. Some of them want a 35% tariff on bad elites like you sending jobs abroad. And others, including leadership of the GOP and the House, go, maybe not. Where are the checks and balances to Mr. Trump's rhetorical excesses?
I think Mr. Ryan is a check and a balance to Mr. Trump's rhetorical excesses. If there is a problem with Mr. Trump, it is that this propensity on the part of he and others around him to put into effect or talk at least about a 35% tariff. What a silly notion that would be, how detrimental that would be to the economy in general. Yes, to small groups of people, to the labor unions, it makes sense. But you have to remember, you put a 35% tariff on a television and suddenly you are spending 35% more to buy that television. And that's the problem. Hopefully that shall not happen. Hopefully we do not take a chapter out of the middle of the 1930s when tariffs, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, took a medium-term and rather substantive recession and turned it into a depression. Hopefully there are wiser voices around. But on balance, I got to tell you, there's a greater sense of optimism out in the great flyover part of the United States than there had been a mere 3 weeks ago. It's demonstrable.
How do you judge Donald Trump's willingness to be checked and balanced in this week since the presidential election? We've watched his Twitter feed with great interest, but you wonder if he's that quick to respond to what the media is saying, for instance, how well he's going to be able to have a conversation about smart trade policy.
That is the great fear, isn't it? And actually, I put that in my newsletter this morning. Won't somebody around him please stop this man from tweeting? The problem is it doesn't appear that anybody's going to have the power to stop him. Please, Melania, stop this man from tweeting.
All jokes aside, though, I mean, here, he has the potential to do some real damage. I mean, you must have been watching what he was saying about China, about Taiwan.
I was not as dismayed about what he said about China as other people were and are. I'm far more dismayed about the intention last week or the decision last week to push Carrier to do what they did, to push UTX to do what it had to do, and then to talk 2 or 3 days later about, once again, putting 35% tariffs into effect. That is bothersome. As long as we can avoid that, and I think we shall avoid that, as long as we can avoid that, things will be fine.
I talk up, Dennis, how you're one of the few people that actually puts your tick-by-tick track record out to the public. It's been a brutal year for people gaming the market. Yeah. Now you enjoy Fortress Diamond, 3.1 standard deviation moonshot on a monthly chart. The last time it did that was from the quiet of 2005, which isn't even comparable. Yeah. What does Dennis Gartman do if you buy and hold the banks and you've gotten this gift? Do you stay with them?
I think you have to. I think there's something that is tectonic that really has occurred. Two things. The banks are going to do so much better over the course of the next 5, 6, 7 years. And two, something I've been arguing about, to put it into simplistic terms, I think that we're going to see the trumping, for lack of a better term, of the Mahoning Valley, the place where steel was born in the United States compared to Silicon Valley.
What does that mean?
I think it means that if the Trump administration means anything, it does in fact mean infrastructure rebuilding, and simple things are going into infrastructure.
Okay, but you, come on, you invented this. Donald Trump took the lesson from you, if it drops on my foot. You own that phrase.
That line, yeah.
What is taking so long for that to happen?
He ain't president yet. Okay, it's that simple. He's not president yet. And it will probably be the whole concept of shovel ready is an utter misnomer. The shovels are ready, but it takes a long time given the fact that all those products or projects have to be done at state and local levels. Federal government can try to do something. Federal government can set the standard. Federal government can fund a bit of it, but the mass funding has to come from the state and from the local from localities, and it takes a long time to get that kind of thing passed through those various legislatures. It will take time, but it is time to buy the things that if you drop them on your foot, shall hurt. And I have to admit, I think that's an interesting and simple, but a correct mnemonic device.
Dennis Gartman with us. We thank all the hate mail for coming in on Gartman. He is the pinata of the street. Here's some hate mail, David Gura, from one D. Cass down in Florida.
Oh,
Doug
no.
Cass says, I'm shorting the banks. I don't agree with Dennis. How do you respond to a guy like Cass, who on a trading basis has been short this great bull market, and now he loads the boat and shorts the banks?
Yeah, but his golf game's getting so much better.
Yeah.
I mean, he sent me a scorecard the other day. He had 3 birdies in a row. Well done, Dougie. Well done.
We say good morning to Mr. Cass. Seriously, folks, Doug Cass, very cautious to short on the banks after the huge surge. David?
Yeah, I'm eager to talk to you about oil. Since we last spoke, we had this OPEC production cut agreement. How optimistic are you that that's going to be upheld?
It won't be upheld. I mean, if history shows anything, it shows you that all OPEC decisions, all OPEC cuts in the past have always been overridden. They cheat. It's just a fact. Are they cheating right now? Well, the interesting thing is they began the cut from an already ramped up September, October, and early November production. So the cut is actually only going to take you back to October levels of production. Two, they will cheat. That's just a matter of that's only a matter of time. The new agreement doesn't go into effect till January 1st. I suspect that by March we will see a rather substantive amount of cheating. And it doesn't even take cheating. It takes us. We are going to continue to be larger and ever greater producers of crude oil. $52 WTI with a $4 contango to the 1 year gives you $56 for 1 year crude, and they're going to sell crude.
We need more jargon than that. We need an additive jargon. What did you just say to the contango?
The contango is the carrying charge. It's the cost.
Of
a tangible asset. And crude is indeed a tangible asset. And for the 1 year, it's the 1 year forward crude oil trades right now at about $2.50 premium to spot. That gives you a fairly comfortable, hedgeable arrangement. And I guarantee you, the banks are telling every E&P producer, produce, hedge, earn the carrying charge, and produce crude oil.
What did the way that meeting went down tell you about the future of this organization, the future of OPEC?
I think the future of OPEC is doomed for no other reason. The smartest guy in the room at OPEC is the deputy crown prince. And he's made it clear he understands 30 years from now, crude oil prices will be zero. It will be worthless. Something else will have supplanted crude oil. He understands that, and he intends to sell his crude before that.
Joseph Nye, Another World From You of International Relations, is adamant about American exceptionalism.
Sure.
I want you to state for us, and it permeates your newsletter, the defeatists of America. What do they get wrong, and particularly what do they get wrong in capitalism?
They get everything wrong. They get, for example, the one thing, there are certain things in this world that you can count on, but you can count on the fact that every year, drought in, rain out, America's farmers are going to produce more and better crops every single year than they did the year before. Technology drives that fact. We are now producing, don't hold me to the number, but perhaps 4 to 5 times more soybeans on the same acreage than we did a mere 30 years ago. We will produce more 10 years from now than we produce now. We have learned through technology how to drill for crude oil so much more efficiently, so much at a much greater pace with a greater success ratio. The defeatists miss what we do. We are the greatest minds in the country when it comes to production.
We enjoy the morning with Dennis Gartman of the Gartman Letter. No, we will not send out his letter. We protect the copyright of all of our guests, and particularly the joy of Dennis Gartman's beliefs in the back of his newsletter. One of his foundation beliefs is gold, not in dollar terms, but in yen and euro terms, It's a really ugly chart.
It really is.
It's a classic pop bull market and then a Trumpian rollover to $11.72 an ounce. Some gurus will tell me support is 900.
It's possible.
Are you long or short the golden beast?
I am still long of gold in euro terms and in yen terms. I have no urge to buy any in dollar terms because I'm a bull on the U.S. dollar. I'd rather own something in terms of a currency that I think is going to devalue in relationship to the buck. But do I wish I owned any gold at all right now? I wish I'd sold a goodly portion of what I had, which is in my retirement fund, 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Wait, we get inflation from Mr. Trump, from the Republicans in Washington.
We may.
We get inflation, gold goes up, right?
Not necessarily. There have been plenty of times when we've had inflationary impulses and gold hasn't gone up. On the other hand, there have been periods of deflation in the past when gold has gone up. Gold, I think, is misunderstood. I don't think it's an inflationary harbor any longer. I think it's simply a currency relative to other currencies. And having started in the business in the early 1970s at dear old NCNB, now Bank of America, when we traded one currency against another, I think of gold as simply being another currency, not a harbor of safety, not a place of value in an inflation.
Tom mentioned the lira a few minutes ago, and you've written about that in your newsletter, the moves that we've seen there. What's driving it, and what do you see as the outlook for that?
You mean the Turkish lira?
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's first of all, I don't trust the Turkish government under Erdogan for as far as I can throw him. And he's fighting a rear guard action. The fact that you had the president of a country come out and say they need to lower rates, and the central bank has in fact right within minutes raised rates, tell you he's got a problem. Where's the Turkish lira going? Probably demonstrably lower, if for no other reason that the dollar itself is demonstrably strong.
Looking at euro dollar right now at 107.37, are you surprised, in light of what we saw in Italy, that it is where it is?
Oh, yeah, I am. I'm surprised. I thought when it looked to me in the middle of the night after the votes had been counted, and when I get up every morning at 1 o'clock in the morning to write the letter, and we were trading 105.20, 105.05 had been given. It looked like 105, the big figure, was going to be given, and then suddenly there was a defense at 105. Next thing you knew, everybody who's short, including myself, ran for cover, and the next thing it's trading 107. But if you take a big look at the big picture over the course of the last year, is that rally from 105 to 107, I think we got a 107.80 bid, if I'm not mistaken, at one time yesterday. Is that technically important? No, the lows are lower, the highs are lower, and it still looks to me like a bear market.
When you look ahead here to the ECB meeting this week, what are your expectations in terms of what we'll hear from Mario Draghi?
I think we'll hear very little. I think they'll kick the football into the next year. It's Christmas time. Their propensity to take any action whatsoever is extremely limited. There will be rhetoric. There will be verbal action. But will there be any real action? I think not.
But again, and it goes to the back half of your newsletter, which is essentially on the exogenous shocks to worry about. What's your outside shock you're worried about?
What am I shocked?
Starting with European banking, but what's the one that keeps Dennis Gartman up at night till 1 a.m. when he writes in granite and chisels out his newsletter?
The one thing that keeps me up at night are the Chinese and whatever they're up to in the South China Sea. That keeps me up at night. I'm always worried about what the North Koreans are capable of doing at any one time. They are more Trumpian than Mr. Trump is, and he at least only tweets. They actually take action at times. I stay awake worrying about that. I stay awake nowadays worrying about what Mr. Trump is going to tweet out. That bothers me far more than it probably should.
One final question. Bill Gross talks about a decade of financial repression. Can you say the financial repression for conservative people, retirees, savers, can you say it's over?
I think it's over. I think we're going to see – I think the 35-year bear market in the bond market in rates, the 35-year bull market in bond prices has ended. I think it ended 6 months ago, and I think rates are going to be not dramatically higher, but certainly demonstrably higher. Can we get the Fed funds rate over the course of the next 3 or 4 years back to 3%? Can we get the 10-year bond, the 10-year note back to a 5% yield? Sure, I think we can do that without doing any damage to the economy.
Independence bull, what's your forecast? The NC State versus
Vanderbilt. That will kick off at noon. Yeah, and I think that both teams will in the words of my high school phys ed teacher Bobby Knight, the team with the most points shall win.
There you go. A sound of forecast as any time.
It's
the Independence Bowl.
The Independence
26th,
Bowl.
I think.
Coming
in December.
Next year, folks. That's the right. Surveillance Bowl.
We're trying.
Dennis
trying hard.
Carman, thank you so much.
Kate Moore joins us, Chief Equity Strategist at BlackRock. As I said, good morning, Kate. Let's start with this referendum and the fallout from it, so much as there is one here in U.S. equity markets. How were market participants, how were investors watching what was going on in Italy?
You know, I think we've been talking a lot about how markets have been shrugging off recent political changes, and I'm wondering really if that's going to extend itself into 2017 as we get further into European elections. You know, there's a sense at one level that there's a bit of a narrative change, that we're going to have more stimulus, that the people are talking, that the government has to answer. And then there's a sense on the other side that, you know, this doesn't actually change meaningfully the path of the economy, particularly, I think, when it comes to the market reaction to Italy. So, I don't know. Is it fair to say the markets have been schizophrenic?
You get this no vote. Renzi's staying on here. But as you say, there's a lot of work to be done here. How optimistic are you that in the next 12, 18 months something is going to happen, or are the politics going to overshadow everything, do you think?
I'm pretty focused on the politics, yeah. To be fair. I would love to tell you that I'm absolutely optimistic that we're going to see a significant acceleration in growth, that all of these changes end up being, you know, just sort of blips on a longer term positive trajectory. But, you know, the thing I keep coming back to is what this does to business confidence, what this does to investment sentiment, you know, and whether or not, given all of this uncertainty, we actually get an increase in spend. Or let's say if you're a consumer or a household and you think about borrowing money, you know, when there's so much political uncertainty and the future of Europe is in question, do you really look to, you know, lever yourself up and, you know, take advantage of this environment? I don't know.
I was going to ask you to answer your rhetorical question there. Yeah.
I would say waiting on the sidelines and being a little bit more cautious is prudent at this point. Continue with business as usual, but perhaps not accelerate any of your spend or investment from here.
I was going to ask you if this is all part of a continuum. We had the news out of France yesterday, another candidate for president there from the socialist center-left side of things. And it strikes me that the longer this continuum gets, the more events like this probably take less import than they would have in the past.
That's right. I wonder if we all have a little bit of political news fatigue, too, because it's been a nonstop array of big events and, you know, analysis of every politician's speech. And we were already in that mode when it came to policymakers, particularly on the monetary side. And now here we are trying to really discern what every politician is trying to try and do and, you know, their policy priorities. The one thing I would also note, though, is, you know, if all of these political changes have huge impacts on currencies and sustained impacts on currencies, and that ends up helping someone's relative purchasing power or the earnings of exporters, I think that may actually help the economy in the near term. But it's really too soon to say how sustainable that is. So you can hear me. I'm a little bit of a skeptic.
There you go. I mentioned those two big monetary policy events, one this week, one next. Is that taking on less importance? Is monetary policy taking on less importance in light of all of the politics that we've seen?
I was totally unaware that we had some monetary policy coming up. Of course, that's not
true.
Happy
to remind you of that.
Of course, that's not true. Yeah. No, I think that actually, you know, if you were to ask me between now and kind of year end, you know, what am I most focused on of any sorts of events, it's actually going to be ECB on Thursday. I'm less interested in the Fed next week, unless there was a meaningful shift and then all of a sudden they decided to step away and not continue the path of normalization. But I think, you know, what the ECB does in terms of talking about bond purchases in 2017 and onwards, whether or not they would consider tapering or extending the program, I think that's going to have a huge impact and will really move markets.
Mm. And there's a small meeting later this week.
Small.
It'll be amazing. I can't imagine what he will say at his always eagerly anticipated press conference. Good morning, everyone. David Gurr and Tom King. Kate Moore with us. Kate, within the rotation, you've said the word rotation four or five times through the morning here as well. I think we need to define that. What is rotation and what does it mean for our listeners' investment?
So when I've been talking about rotation, you're right, Tom, totally fair to call me out on using that word a dozen times this morning, but I'm only one cup of tea in.
Yeah.
What I would say is this rotation within the equity market happened and started to happen before the U.S. election. It was away from some of the bond proxy stocks. You know, broadly, we'll say that's utilities, telecom, and consumer staples, and towards some of the more value and cyclical plays, particularly towards financials, I would say, and energy. That accelerated after the election, and you can actually really see a meaningful departure from first half performance, second half performance, and then, you know, supercharged in the last month. That's what I'm talking about in terms of the rotation, and really away from, you know, investor darlings into sectors people had much lower exposure to.
So help me, and maybe this goes with the Roper merger that was just announced. I believe Karen Moscow got that into her discussion. They're buying, is it Dell Tech,
yep,
David?
That's right, yeah.
Roper Technologies, getting it up here, of Sarasota, Florida, 10,000. They manufacture, they distribute industrial equipment. Those are the people Donald Trump wants to help. We mentioned tariffs before. How do you fold the president-elect's rhetoric, maybe policy, and actually your guesstimate of his real policy into buying, acquiring shares of industrials, and then here's the hard part, and then holding them?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Tom, that's a great question, I would say, because industrials are the one sector where I think there's a huge amount of uncertainty. The market did price in an absolutely optimistic scenario, both in terms of infrastructure spend and onshoring, but it's really not so straightforward. And in fact, I would just take us back a few weeks to how companies in that sector guided, not just for fourth quarter, the forward quarter, but also for the next 12 months. It was very, very mixed, Tom. And I think that's what we need to recognize. We have to also look at the policy changes, but focus on the fundamentals. And, you know, I'd say I'm a little bit cautious. Yeah. You know, given the recent run in the sector.
Yeah, market priced it in very fast. Too fast, do you think? I mean, is it overshooting there a bit?
You know, you look at those first couple days post the election, and some of these potential policies got priced in very, very quickly and then backed off. I would say the big example there would be large cap pharma and, you know, kind of broadly healthcare, where there was a great amount of optimism, a bit of a relief rally, and then sort of a, well, we don't know what this means for affordable care, and we're still concerned about pricing when it comes to private insurers. So, you know, and a bit of a back off. But then some of the stuff has continued to run. And those are the sectors, as I mentioned before, that were already in favor and moving ahead of the election.
Help us understand the weight of the variable of trade policy here. A lot of people saying, we heard what he had to say on the campaign trail, heard what Donald Trump had to say on the campaign trail. He's going to limit what he's said when he gets into office itself. And then we see these tweets over the weekend. As you're looking ahead to the health of the economy, how much is that weighing on your outlook?
I think trade policy is enormous. Mm. People, we can't separate out what could happen to the U.S. dollar, or what could happen to the global supply chain, or what could happen to the average cost of goods purchased by the average consumer who has not actually experienced significant wage gains or any wage gains. And I think stuff sounds good when it comes out perhaps on a tweet. It looks like it's protecting the American people. But there's a far distance between some of that rhetoric and a positive impact in terms of overall spending.
Kate Moore with us with BlackRock. We've been talking up a storm here on the break. Let's talk about technology and hydrocarbons. There's always a point where something gets stupid within the S&P valuation, like it makes up 21 or 18% or whatever of the S&P 500 index. I would suggest hydrocarbons right now aren't stupid. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing sort of big, ugly technologies, not stupid. But is technology a value trap? What portion of the S&P is it? And is it a value trap?
Look, without question, the importance of technology has increased. But I would say, you know, it's hard for me to say it's a value trap. The multiples didn't get crazy. There was actually so much earnings growth and sales growth in that sector for a long time. It's obviously slowed a little bit, and estimates for 2017 are not as aggressive. But, you know, it is a sector, I think, that incorporates some real high-flying companies and some kind of older tech, and where it may pay to be a little bit more specific and discerning. I would also say it's a sector that was a huge consensus overweight for some time. And a consensus overweight going into this rotation, I want to use it for 13 times now, Tom. In that started in the beginning. The second half of 2016. So it's a place where I think people can continue to reduce their positions in order to fund some of their buying into energy or into cyclicals or some of the kind of a more value place I was mentioning in terms of U.S. bank stocks.
There was so much commentary after the election, looking at technology in specific, which was down on the heels of the election results, that it was directly attributable to what happened on November the 8th.
Yeah.
Looking back at the election now, is there anything that we've seen since that you can tie that to, or is it just the uncertainty generally? In terms of rotation, it's not that.
Well, you could argue if it was just about the election, then people should really like a lot of these technology companies with huge amounts of cash offshore. And if that's coming back, and it would be great to own the shares, especially if some portion of that cash is used for buybacks or special dividends. But I think this was really about people getting more constructive on the banks, which were the consensus underweight, and which we had become more constructive on and sort of had been talking about throughout the fall. And that needing to fund, find some place to actually, to get cash to decrease that underweight. And I don't even think we're at neutral yet, frankly.
Are they still underweight?
Yes, I think so. Not meaningfully underweight, but modestly underweight. Look, I've had a number of conversations within BlackRock, outside of BlackRock, where portfolio managers and investors have said, if they were overweight, the banks going in, or at least neutral, they felt pretty good about it. But the speed at which these stocks moved has made them cautious about doubling or tripling down. Yeah. So I think that people are still phasing into the sector.
Mike, I'll give you a phase into the sector. J.P. Morgan is basically a moonshot. I mean, if you look at it on a monthly basis, and you look at two David, it's where's that chart again? There it is. It means way out past three standard deviations on a monthly chart. It's a moonshot.
I'm quite familiar with the shape of the J.P. Morgan.
75 to 83.
Yeah.
I thought the bank was about ready to fall apart after you left.
I hardly think that's the case. It is a very, very solid institution. Probably didn't even notice I was gone, Tom. But the point of the matter is,
Jamie Dimon wore black for 3 weeks after you left.
I wear black every day.
But you, seriously, you're telling me the banks are a value too big to fail?
I know. I think the banks have so many things going for them at this point. Outstanding balance sheets, which we knew, better cash return to shareholders, which we knew, which was sort of like skeptically taken in by the market. We actually also were seeing good green shoots. I hate using green shoots, but it's green shoots in terms of economic expansion.
We're rotating. Excuse me. We're rotating to green shoots, David.
We're pretty constructive on the U.S. economy and actually see good reason to believe we were going to get an acceleration in growth, not just because of this election, but just in terms of overall demand in 2017. In addition, if we have less regulatory pressure, I think that's a real help. And of course, we've got this reflationary theme, which is steepening the yield curve, and it's going to help overall earnings, we think, especially over the next couple quarters. There are a lot of things that have aligned at the same time to make the banks an interesting buy.
J.P. Morgan is out three standard deviations for the first time since May of 2006, and then it was from extremely quiet 2004, 2005. That's how rare the Trump surge is for Mr. Dimon. Fortress Trump. Maybe that's what we'll call J.P. Morgan. Kate Moore, thank you so much. She is with BlackRock, giving us wisdom on the equity
Fortress Trump, Tom,
markets.
I think he's on 5th Avenue and 56th.
There it was yesterday. I didn't lie this time to go across one block. Okay. The New York Police Department called me up and said, you're a bad influence. Yes, I'm going to Gucci. We'll continue. This is Bloomberg. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role as to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have a legend on the line from Rye, New York. That's Mario Gabelli, founder of Gabelli Funds, schooled by Dodd and Graham, joining us now by phone from Rye. As I say, Mario, good morning. Great to have you with us.
Delighted to be here. Talk about stocks.
There you go. Well, let me ask you, first of all, what these last few weeks have been like. We've been talking with guests about how they processed what happened on November the 8th, going into the morning afterward. Give us your sense of what's happened here and how it's changed your outlook.
Hasn't changed anything other than the reestablishment of a basic fundamentals of allocation of capital towards capitalism as opposed to socialism. In any event, both Hillary and Donald were basically going to push for a couple of areas that were fairly obvious, one of which was infrastructure spending, the other one was military spending. So, you know, we were there. And the change in administration basically allows new changes at who is going to run the regulatory agency, like the Federal Communications Commission. What does that mean? And things like, banks and consolidation in the banking industry.
You bring up infrastructure. Let's start there. There was so much enthusiasm among investors after Donald Trump was elected. A lot of people betting on the fact that there is going to be an infrastructure spending package. When you look at a sector-by-sector basis, when you look at utilities, say, is it oversold at this point?
Well, you're off the deep end. Let's talk about infrastructure. Cement, roads, bridges, inland waterway, locks on the Mississippi where our grain goes to export, like soybeans are a big export product. That's got to be focused on. We've got to eliminate the bottlenecks and just drive around Manhattan. Independent of all of that, what does infrastructure mean? It means airports and equipment rental companies, URI, Ashtead in London, Herc Rentals, and there's three or four others. They benefit. It's a $45 billion industry that was hidden. But you go back one year ago, December 15, 2015, the U.S. government passed a five-year bill for highway fixer-upper called Fast Fix America Surface Transportation. Stocks like a company in Chattanooga doubled before this happened. It's called Aztec. Companies like Genco, which make asphalt equipment, those will continue to get tailwinds.
Mario, how do you respond to somebody who says, okay, that's great, Mario, I read in Barron's from you or listened to you on surveillance, on URI, United Rentals. Talk about you can't make money in stocks, folks. 14.9% per year over the last decade. How do you respond, Mario, to a person who says, I didn't get in, I'm too late?
Well, that's the question mark that's always good. I think Buffett makes the case, and I'll just echo his comments about the next 10 years. America is great. American investing will be terrific. And to the degree that you own a company and you buy hold, look, if you bought Warren Buffett's company somewhere around 1977 when I started the firm, you probably compounded at 20%. At any time over the last 30 years, people would say it's overpriced. So I'm think that an index fund will grow from 7-9%, and active management will do better.
I need you to get you wound up this morning. Mario Gabelli on the people that say companies shouldn't do share buybacks, they should stop financial engineering, they should go out and find investment even if it doesn't work. That upsets you a little bit, doesn't it?
Not really. I think it's not inappropriate to allocate capital to the way a CEO thinks, to the degree that you were basically putting money in 20 years ago in open-heart furnaces because you were in that business and you wanted to continue in that business. Yeah. That was not smart. Just think of Cuba. Just think of China. They did the same thing. So when you look at the American capitalistic system, you want to allow, with all of the errors and all of the mistakes, allow that capital to be formulated and put in. I have no problem if a company is selling materially below intrinsic value to buy it.
Is 30 seconds and we're going to come back, Mario. Is Donald Trump good for Mario Gabelli?
I think the notion of a lower corporate taxes, global competitiveness for American industry, somewhat less regulation, and the reestablishment of the entrepreneurial innovation, creative innovation that made America great is not bad for any entrepreneur like myself and anyone else that wants to succeed.
To give you an idea of the pixie dust of Mario Gabelli, and trust me, folks, there's years that he would rather forget. Rarely, if ever, have I seen back-to-back years in the 94th percentile. That would be the Gabelli Equity Trust, a closed-end fund, GAB. Mario, did the banks have anything to do with your 2012-2013 excellence?
No, I think it was a combination of transactions and coming off the lackluster performance in the prior years. Talking about banks, that we're looking at all of the banks in Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida that will be part of a consolidation effort. So, anything under $2 or $3 billion, all of a sudden they've got a new tailwind, Tom.
Well, how does it change? How does the bank analysis dialogue change with the politics of Washington?
Oh, I think it's fairly simple. They eliminate they raise the ceiling of $50 billion before you have to file a large number of extra forms. And the list is pretty simple. Anybody can just go out and get a Russell 2000 index of banks and identify those areas rather than me identifying them for you. But that's easy. It just requires a little elbow grease. On the other side, in the infrastructure area, one of my favorites is Case New Holland. It's a farm equipment company. It's a construction equipment company. They have trucks in Europe, which is improving. And the stock's around $8.75 in U.S. and CNHI, and it's controlled by the Agnelli family. And I think it's quite attractive. So there's a whole bunch, Tom, when you say about entry points. What do I want to own? How do I make money over the next 3 or 4 years? And how do I pay lower capital gains taxes during that period while I'm holding it? That's what the individual investor is thinking about, not the professional investor that's managing tax-free money, though.
Tom mentioned your prowess for media in particular, and our colleague David Weston sat down with Les Moonves, the president, chairman, and CEO of CBS yesterday. I know that you have been actively watching and engaged with the conversations about the future of Viacom, the future of CBS. Are you looking forward to, do you want to see here a merger, a deal with both these companies, and do you want to see Moonves running it?
Basically, Les is terrific, one of the great executives in America. We have blessed this country with so many good CEOs. Basically, the decision is going to be made, obviously, by National Amusements. National Amusements, obviously, is trying to go through the fairness. Our clients own most of the majority, the minority, in terms of voting stock in both CBS and Viacom. So hopefully, if there's an issue in terms of fairness and extreme of fairness opinions, we will have an important say in it. And we're not opposed to a merger. We've gone through this before. Viacom was spun off from CBS. They bought CBS, and a lot of things going on.
Within
these are small companies.
Within the dynamics here, Murray, is a basic idea of animal spirit. I guess we believe. I just did a chart of the monthly J.P. Morgan chart. It's a moonshot, folks, at 3.1 standard deviations. I mean, it is a Trump moonshot on the equity markets. Would you suggest M&A? I mean, I was with you, Mario, one day, and the next day Cadbury was taken out. Is that game going to continue?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Cadbury, because one of the ones on potentially a transaction list is one that, you know, Irene Rosenfeld went after Cadbury, and Mondelez is certainly at around $41, kind of an interesting consolidation play on its own. Either they're going to buy someone or someone will merge with them to create scale on a global basis, Tom.
How is the environment for the atmosphere for mergers and acquisitions right now?
Well, it's not changed. We go through the last 60 years, and we go through a variety of cycles. And this one here, you know, may have some tailwind, particularly if you allow capital to be flowed back to the United States and have a corporate tax that is not based on world taxation but territorial taxation, so that companies in the United States, particularly big pharma, utilities will merge. You get a whole bunch of companies that will consolidate. And the entertainment business is just another example. And content and connectivity. So you'll see a lot of potential deals. Even this morning while we're talking to you, I just tweeted that XYZ company is being taken over in a cash tender offer.
Mario, let's do some constructive job advice for our global Wall Street audience. To the young Turk, who's level one, level two, level three CFA, they're doing securities analysis either full-time or they're certainly aware of it. What is the new for you in terms of analyzing a company's performance and potential?
Well, we just look at how management allocates capital, Tom. But nothing's changed. I mean, basically, it's Graham Dodd, Murray Greenwald, that methodology. You know, if you want to be the CEO of a public company, if you want to do deals and be private equity, if you want to understand how to do merger and acquisition work, you know, the notion of doing fundamental research and sticking to it, the problem is getting paid for it. Ever since Spitzer put his rules out, it has become extraordinarily hard for the sell side, which is a great training ground, to pay for analysts. And so where are the analysts going? Where are they doing their work? The quandary.
Tell me about General Electric. If it's about the CEO and allocation of capital, has Mr. Immelt done a good job?
Well, clearly this deal with Baker Hughes and merging their energy business into that And look at what they're doing in the additive area with Joyce, who runs their engine business, making acquisitions in Europe because he wants to get into the three-dimensional metal additive business. You know, they've got to move capital around. They've been shrinking the cap. The stock is a pretty good surrogate for industrial activity on a global basis. Clearly, they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with their water business and obviously some other industries. So the notion of capitalism is to allow you to make managements to make mistakes and, you know, make acquisitions and also sell investments, but at the same time reposition the company for the dynamics of growth and not stay frozen like Cuba did for 50 years.
I hear you talking about the need for tax reform, for regulatory reform, and I wonder the degree to which you're working hard to make sure that Donald Trump is hearing you out. Are you somebody who wants your opinions known? We're talking about him here, but are you satisfied this is a president-elect who's listening to guys like you?
I hope he's not listening to me. There are a lot smarter people out there that can give him advice. I'm just basically an old-fashioned stock picker that has done work hard for my clients, and that's all we're going to focus on. No politics, no sex, no religion. But we will listen to Tom Keene and Bloomberg.
We're going to leave it there after that, Shane. And on that note, Mario, thank you so much. Mario Gabelli, greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.